This week's episode of the FitCast is brought to you by TurbulenceTraining.com. Boost muscle growth and blowtorch body fat at TurbulenceTraining.com. This is the FitCast. Welcome to this week's episode of the FitCast, FitCast episode number 9 for Sunday, June 11th, 2006. My name is Kevin Larrabee.
And I'm John Williams.
And this week we're joined by Eric Cressy, who is known for his articles on T-Nation, Elite Fitness, and in Men's Fitness. Also, you might know him for his DVD, Magnificent Mobility. Hello, Eric.
Hey, thanks guys for having me.
Welcome to the show. Good to have you on.
My pleasure. This is great.
That's a good time. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Eric?
Sure. Actually, right now, you could probably call me the busiest unemployed guy in the world. I left the facility where I was at April 15th, and we're actually in the process of opening up a new spot up in Boston, or just outside of Boston, Excel Sports and Fitness Training. So prior to that, I spent the last couple of years up at UConn finishing my master's, where I did a lot of work with the varsity athletes up there, especially men's and women's basketball, men's and women's soccer, and also some work with the Human Performance Lab and things like that. So prior to that, I did my undergrad at University of New England, double major in the sports and fitness management, exercise science. So I've got plenty of academia under my belt and just more excited right now about being out in the real world. So lots of writing and powerlifting too, so a little bit of everything. So whatever you can throw my way is cool with me.
Sounds good. Can you tell us a little bit about this Excel Sports and Fitness?
Oh, yeah, it's looking good. It's actually going to be the three co-owners are Brad Cardoza, who's a pro strongman, John Sullivan, who's actually a very accomplished strongman as well, and also Rebecca Manda, who's done well as a rower in the past, and all of them are pretty established in the greater Boston area as really good trainers and performance enhancement coaches. We've got Matt Delaney involved, who's a very good Olympic lifting coach, and also Carl Valley, who's located up in Boston as well, who's very well known working with swimmers and track athletes up in the area. So we've got a broad, you know, class of people coming together to kind of bring unique things to the table. So all in all, it's just a really exciting place. 5,800 square feet, great equipment, and we had the grand opening yesterday. So things are looking good and just really excited about building some freaky athletes and weekend warriors alike.
Very nice. And where is it in Boston?
It's actually in Waltham, right off of Route 128.
Oh, Waltham, yeah.
So, yeah, not too far from the city, but, you know, close enough so that you don't have to deal with the traffic too bad.
Right. You can hit up the Brandeis University afterwards.
Exactly, yeah. Brandeis and Bentley are right there. So
yeah.
Lots of schools right in the area. So, yeah, it should be real, real good. We're excited.
Excellent. Do you have a website for that?
It's excelstrength.com.
Excellent.
We should probably mention about the dog in the background.
Yeah, I didn't know if my noise cancellation thing was working, but apparently not. I have a very vocal husky who's getting brushed right now. So. Once again, Williams is disturbing the show. Sorry about that.
At least you got excuses for good noises in the background. I don't think I got anything up my sleeve for that one. So hopefully I run it clear tonight.
Yeah, Eric, I'm really disappointed I couldn't get out there this Saturday. Unfortunately, Best Buy needed me to sell some TVs.
Very important, but I'm going to be coming by to hit you up in a few months when I'm officially up there. So,
oh, definitely.
It's all well worth it. Just don't get fired in the meantime, right?
I'm going to make a trip down there sooner or later. So.
Good deal. We'll be waiting for you.
Awesome. Possibly, this actually kind of trends into our news for this week for the FitCast, just our FitCast news, which is episode number 2 of the FitCast will be coming up within a week or a week and a half. We got a good response for the first video episode of the FitCast. John, what did you think of it? I know you thought it was kind of ridiculous, but
it was good. I thought it was hilarious. You were doing we talked about this when Lou Schuler was on the show, trying to combine diet sodas and protein powders. And I always thought, yeah, of course, it's just a joke, but you actually tried it out.
Yeah.
And just like you, I had high hopes for that vanilla root beer thing, like a root beer float.
Oh,
but just watching your face on that video, it was just cracking me up.
I was impressed with your perseverance. I thought you did pretty well to make it through the whole show.
My stomach
tapped out after the first two or three.
Yeah, my stomach wasn't doing too good after the first three of them.
All that carbonation.
Yeah, the carbonation and the whey protein just does not mix very well.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'll ever do that again.
Yeah, well, does it just like foam up? Is it just all foamy, or is it only because you put it in a blender that it's foamy? Is it just some sort of chemical reaction between the whey protein and the soda?
Yeah, I think it's just from the blender. I usually, before we started recording, after it was blended, we let them sit for about a minute. But especially with the fruit punch whey protein, which was actually the best tasting if you saw it.
Yeah.
They just were really foamy from the carbonation, and I used too much ice on some of them, but I wasn't going to remix them. I was just, I couldn't do it again, so.
Well, that is cool overall, man. We should continue with this little video podcast stuff. If we can ever get ourselves together, you know, the three of us, we could do like an on-location podcast. That'd be
good
cool.
Deal.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, definitely no one knows what the future holds. If U.S. Airways wants to be a sponsor for the FitCast, you can email me at kevinlarby@gmail.com. But no, in all seriousness, we might actually have a second sponsor as well, which would be Greens Plus.
Awesome.
So they've actually been bouncing back emails with me, and they're discussing it with their, I guess, the people that make the decisions up there. And I'd be really happy to have them as a sponsor. We already talk about them all the time.
Yeah, and that was not preconceived by any means.
No.
We weren't trying to get them as a sponsor, but that'd be great if they were.
I don't know. We're going to find out this Tuesday, so I'll let everyone know either on the website or on episode number 10. And also, again, on the Video Fitcast, is there anything you want me to cover for Video Fitcast? I have a couple ideas, and also I might go down and see Eric for one of the video episodes, which would be great, and definitely do some strongman demonstrations or something like that.
We could bring you down for a Friday night at Southside. It usually tends to be a revolutionary experience for a lot of people.
Nice.
So, lots of eye-opening things are said, so we might have to do that once in a while. But
has there ever been a video camera inside the
West? You know, that's a good question. They talked about doing a DVD, but I'm not sure that the cameraman would make it out alive.
Yeah.
So we've got an interesting crew, but we have a lot of fun. So as long as you got thick skin, you can do well. It's especially tough for me. I mean, I'm the lightest guy in the history of the gym. So, you know, I was the first guy to put a total on the board at 165. And unfortunately, they're all patting me on the back now that I'm bumping up a few weight classes. So
nice.
And also transitioning into iTunes. I know a lot of you have been subscribing through iTunes, and please keep doing so. Tell your friends about them. And if you're not subscribing through iTunes, please do so. And also put reviews for the FitCast on iTunes. The more subscribers we get, the higher we go up, and then the more listeners we get from just being higher in the ranks. Right now we float between 20 and 40, depending on what time during the week. But definitely check that out if you haven't already, and it's just much easier for you to download it, and it just shows up right when you open iTunes when the new show's out. So
awesome. Also, Podcast Alley.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You can vote there too, and it's monthly. I know that we put a message up on the JP Fitness forums last month, and we got a good response, and we jumped up to number 4 in the rankings on the health and fitness genre. So if you haven't done it again this month, please do so. It's just a quick process. You click on vote, and then they send you an email, and you click on the link in your email, and you're all set.
Definitely. And also, I know this show is coming out on Monday, and that might actually it'll be out Sunday at midnight, but if you're listening to it on Monday, that might be the normal way it's going to be for us this summer. As I'm working at Best Buy, it's really hard for me to get Saturday or Friday nights off because this is the busy time, so that might be when we are going to have to record. But we'll always see how it turns out. It might come out a couple days earlier, a couple days, well, within the weekend, we'll just say that.
Sounds good. Can't be definite,
yeah.
Well, most people probably download it in the morning anyway, Monday morning, on their commute to work.
Yeah, it seems like that's what a lot of people are doing, which is really cool. But anyways, we should probably jump into our shakes this week. I'll start off first, just having 2 scoops of Metabolic Drive. Again, I'm not very creative this week, but it's actually, for some people who just ordered Metabolic Drive in the last week or so, they actually changed the formula around, which I don't know if it's the greatest change that they made, but I guess they got some higher quality proteins in it, and it changed the taste of the chocolate metabolic drive. Some people are positive and negative about it, but I kind of miss the old formula, to be honest.
Yeah? There's a different taste?
Yeah, it has a different aftertaste. I guess and it's not as thick. It's a little bit thinner, but I guess they had a problem with the manufacturing, so they went from one formula to the new formula, but now they're going back to the old formula again. So only, I don't know how many people got the new shipment of the metabolic drive, but they're going to be going back to the new old version if you're ordering right now.
So it's like the new Coke.
Well, they had a manufacturing mix-up.
Oh, I see. What kind of new protein were they putting in there?
I think they just put more. They took out the calcium caseinate, and they put in. I think they just put in more milk proteins.
Yeah.
I don't know if Eric, if you know anything about this.
You know, I should know more. It's pretty bad. I get a free goodie package from BioTest every month, and I just don't know what goes on behind the scenes. I do know I'm a happy guy when it shows up on my doorstep on the first Friday of every month, but
absolutely.
Beyond that, I couldn't tell you too much. I would think that if it's thinning out a little bit, they might use a little bit more of the whey isolate. It's tough to say, though.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people are saying on the on the boards. Like, if you go to T-Nation, there's actually a couple articles about it on the site about the update and how they're going back to the old formula. But overall, I mean, BioTest is really great. And they also have, if you haven't checked out, Hot Rocks Extreme, which is brand new. They have a new formula for Hot Rocks as well.
Nice.
That's it for me. I'll be quiet for now.
Eric, what are you drinking?
You know, I haven't been too creative either. I've been traveling a lot myself, but I will say one thing I did try this week, more of a post-workout thing, is I was keeping my carbs a little bit low, so not using a ton of Surge, but I just mixed some Surge with actually some strawberry metabolic drive just to keep my protein up, and gave a little strawberry vanilla ring, and it was actually pretty good. It turned out well. So a little change of pace, not too much, but I'm a conservative guy by nature, so I didn't go too overboard, but I'm not quite ready for the diet sodas and protein shakes, so I've got to build my way up to that.
Kevin took one for the team for us on that one.
Exactly. He got a gold star for that one.
Lou Schuler owes me one there. He hasn't talked, emailed me or anything about that, but I should probably send him an email and see what he thought.
Well, that's pretty cool. I've never heard anybody mixing Surge with some other flavor. That's a good idea, actually. It's like
a little change of pace. Nothing too dramatic.
Food. Yeah.
Yeah, it was real good, though.
Well, like both of you, I'm also lazy this week, or actually I don't have the means to be creative this week because I'm moving into a new home. Don't even have my shake station set up yet. So I just put in a couple of scoops of Muscle Milk Rocky Road flavor together with some ice. So I'm just sipping on that, and it's a good standby. You know, Muscle Milk is always pretty tasty, and it's a good sort of anytime meal. So pretty happy with that.
You can't go wrong there. Now that we're done with the shakes, let's head into this week's news. All right, for this week's news story, it's actually a news story I picked out from the NewYorkTimes.com. It was on eating disorders. It was actually an essay written by, I guess you could almost say, a soccer mom. I guess we could give her a little bit more credit than that, but she just wrote about eating disorders in school and how it affects the children and how schools are trying to deal with it. I'm not going to go in detail too much because in the end, I didn't really like the article too much, but I'll have a link for it up on the fitcast.com, like with all the other show notes. But what did you guys think about it?
You want to go first? Or you want to go ahead, John. Go ahead.
I kind of agree with Kevin. A little too all over the place. She didn't really have a good point. Basically, her premise was that, you know, we shouldn't be so obsessive about what our kids eat because kids are going to want what they can't have. And if you force them to eat broccoli and take away their sodas in the classroom, then they're just going to gorge on sodas when they get a chance. And, I agree with that premise. And I also agree to some extent with what she's saying that anytime you get government involved, they have a tendency to make a bureaucracy out of things, and just look at the war on drugs. It just doesn't work. But she quotes some statistics in there that I just don't agree with, and basically she didn't have a very clear idea of what to do afterwards. One thing I noticed, she mentioned that these report cards in Arkansas said that the governor Huckabee started including the BMI of the students on the report cards. And she was like, you know, my God, if the students don't have to worry about their grades enough already, they're going to have to worry about, you know, their report cards showing that they're hugely obese.
That did take a bit far, didn't it?
Yeah, it does on the surface. But if you go and read, you know, what Huckabee has done, it's pissed off a lot of parents, but a lot of them did something about it. And in Arkansas, you can see that after this practice started going on, parents started taking their kids to pediatricians about weight problems more often. The fitness class attendance is up at an all-time high, and diet pill use among high school students is down. So it's having some positive effect. You know, I don't know if I entirely agree with putting your BMI in a report card, but at least it's something so far. So she kind of ignores this thing, and I think she's sort of playing into the hands of some of these smear campaigns, sort of this swift boating, if you will, of certain nutritionists or certain people, investigative reporters who write books about fast food and childhood obesity, people like Schlosser, who wrote Fast Food Nation, and with his new book Chew on This, he's been accused of trying to lead children away from capitalism and into this quote-unquote failed socialist ideology. I mean, it gets crazy, and I think this sort of gives ammunition to these folks who are just out to say, oh, these people are full of it, you know, they don't really know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. I think she could add a better conclusion, at least.
Yeah, it kind of cracked me up. She seemed like kind of like Kevin said, kind of an overzealous soccer mom. I didn't really see any credentials behind it, but again, it was more of an editorial piece, I think, and the statistics were kind of inherently self-serving. So, but yeah. The thing I thought was kind of funny is she went to great lengths to talk about how, like, high school health classes were notorious for causing eating disorders. And I want to say that, you know, right out loud, is the truth is that most eating disorders have a genetic component. I actually have done a lot of research on this myself. In the University of North Carolina, they actually found like 56% of eating disorders have a genetic component. It relates to increased levels of serotonin in the anorexic brain and all that. And to be honest, you know, when you're looking at the high school health class and the middle school health classes, all you're looking at is the trigger. It's like the straw that breaks the camel's back. Like, you have to look at the genetic factors, and then even beyond that, you have to look at the environmental factors that contribute to someone developing that tendency over the years. And you know, when it comes down to it, you know, any kind of eating disorder really revolves around like obsessive compulsive disorder. People who don't have control in their lives are looking to find control wherever they can, whether it's by restricting what they eat or just exercising a ton, things like that. So in that regard, you need to look to these people's, you know, home lives and say, you know what, why do they have no control in their life? Is it because, you know, there's alcoholism in their family? Is it because there's spousal abuse? Is it because, you know, they're naturally stressed out people? And if you actually look at the demographics of anorexics in America, you're usually going to find that they're very commonly the overachievers, the kids that do everything right, but they just don't feel like they have control over the rest of their lives. So, you know, I think we're looking, you know, kind of the wrong end of the spectrum. I mean, it's not the health classes and the, you know, the report cards and things like that that are causing these. It's all the other factors that have, you know, accumulated over the years.
Right.
But, and the other thing that cracked me up was she was talking about how her own kids, I guess, how she had, you know, made sure that they ate healthy at home and all that, and then they went to their friend's house, and the first thing they did was ask for ice cream when they got there. And she's like, you know, it would have been smarter if I had just let them have ice cream, you know, throughout. And I'm like, well, you know, doesn't it make more sense to let them have ice cream once every 2 weeks than have let them have it every night just so that they feel more satisfied? I'm like, you know, kids want money too, but you don't give them just $50 every day and hope that you're going to foster some qualities in them. So that kind of cracked but I don't know.
Yeah, you need to instill some values in kids, you know.
I don't have kids, though, so I'm not allowed to have any opinions on this, apparently.
I know, none of us have kids. I have a husky that's almost like a kid. Moving on, the next article that we're going to be discussing today is something I pulled off of Lou Schuler's blog again. That's a cornucopia of useful information over at LouSchuler.com. Basically, the article is another New York Times article. It's discussing the benefits of alcohol consumption on heart health. And the title is, "For Heart Health, Liquor is Quicker for Women and Slower for Men." Basically, a Danish study found that an alcoholic drink a day can significantly reduce the risk for heart disease in men, but women get almost the same benefit with only one drink a week. So basically, they're showing that it's beneficial for both men and women, but men and women receive benefits differently according to how frequently they drink it. For women, they can have you know, the occasional alcoholic drink once a week or so, and that provides protective health benefits for them. Whereas men, basically, the more frequently you drink, the better off you are for not getting heart disease. So I thought it was just kind of a fun article to discuss. It's yet another one of these studies showing that alcohol ain't all that bad for some people, at least if you're trying to protect against heart disease. And it's not this big evil thing that a lot of people try to make it out to be. What'd you guys think?
I don't know. I think it's a little concerning in the sense that we know that all Americans have a tendency to let the pendulum swing a little too far in one direction. So one drink a week becomes, you know, eight drinks a night and things like that. But I mean, my feeling on all this, I mean, yeah, you know, a glass of wine a night, you know, when you're into your 60s and things like that, that's all well and good. But, you know, if you're someone who's very physique-minded, as I assume a lot of the people on, you know, that are listening to this call are, you know, there are a lot of ways to improve your heart health. I mean, you can exercise, you can eat more fiber, you can do a lot of different things. I mean, alcohol is known, you know, to promote, you know, increases in estrogen, things like that. So, I mean, I'm wondering if it's, you know, if we're going to be cutting off our face, I mean, our nose in spite of our face and this stuff. But right. I don't know. I mean, I don't think a drink here and there is going to hurt people. But I just question whether this is something that's really targeted to our audience per se, or, you know, an older generation who's more concerned with just staying alive rather than being in optimal performance and really looking the part.
Right. Good points. And I pulled up another article. It's actually a letter in the same journal who published this article. And basically the authors of that letter were saying, that's great that they're looking at this objectively, but the media is portraying it as it's a free-for-all. Go out and drink as much as you can if you're a man, you know. And they're saying, you know, they're quoting the alcohol misuse and the problems that occur out of that, and that it's alcohol misuse is steeply on the rise in the UK, particularly in older individuals. So that creates a whole new host of problems, you know. So again, moderation is the key on that.
Yeah, I mean, we know, like, you can even say the same thing with, like, the, you know, low-carb diets. I mean, yeah, we know that they work great. The research is out there. We did a lot of the research. We still are up at UConn with Dr. Bullock and Cass Forsyth. But at the same time, you know, people think, oh, you know what? High-fat diets are great. That's good. I'm going to get some sausage and smother it in lard, and I'll be golden. Like, you know what? You could probably eat some salmon. You could, you know, have some chicken with some fish oil and some olive oil. I mean, you know, some nuts. It's not like that. But we like to go to extremes around here, so.
Yeah, way back when. Way back when, I used to be a barista at Starbucks back when I was in college. And there was a woman who came in, and she was on the Atkins diet or some low-carb diet. Mm-hmm. And she had it all wrong. She was like, okay, I need a venti latte, and instead of milk, I want you to put whipping cream in it. So I gave her like a double shot of espresso and then, you know, steamed up some whipping cream. And I looked at, you know, if you look at the nutritional information on whipping cream, it's like the equivalent of liquid butter, you know. So she was drinking like a 5,000 calorie drink, and she's like, yeah, I'm doing good, you know, no, very little carbs on this. I can eat as much fat as I want. So she loved it, man. She gobbled that stuff down.
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm kind of on the same boat with Eric, and just, I mean, all in moderation, and even with alcohol, a lot of kids at college drink alcohol, and they kind of bring up the fact, like, oh, I mean, even jokingly, oh, I'm just doing it for my health, you know, they always say you can get one drink a day, and I just make it up for all the weekends, and I have eight, or something like that, and just, I mean, I choose just even not to drink at all, like, it's, I'm one of the, like, few college students that just, I don't know, it just doesn't do much for me, and it doesn't really benefit me, and I might just stay away from it all in all. It's, I don't really even have a taste for it. I don't know if guys just get a taste for it, if or even guys or women in general get a taste for it, but I just never really got into that crowd, I guess.
And more power to you. I didn't spend a penny on alcohol in my college career.
Yeah,
I'm happy to say. Although, yeah. Occasionally I can relax a little bit around here, but yeah, it's the truth. You'll be more productive in the long run because of it, but that's not to say you can't go out and have fun anyway.
Well, I don't know. Would they even, like, say that you'd have better heart health staying away from alcohol completely?
That's tough to say.
Yeah. I guess it depends on the case study, on the individual. I mean, I think they're saying that if you're predisposed to heart disease, then it's probably better. You'd be better off if you had a drink a day. Something like this, but... You know, as you guys are saying, you can't use an excuse for alcoholism if you're a college student and you're binging every night.
Yeah.
It's obviously not to your benefit.
it's another example of kind of the research world doesn't necessarily apply to, you know, our little contingent in the, you know, in the weightlifting community, in the sense
right.
that, you know, they do a lot of research on untrained subjects, you know, just there's all these other factors they don't control for. And, you know, are these people performing at high levels? Are they eating a very clean diet? Are they concerned with how they look? Are they just concerned with not dying? There's kind of a big gap.
Well, didn't Arnold used to put whiskey in his post-workout shake?
He might have. I haven't seen that video now later, isn't it? So.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should try to get him on the show. I was thinking about getting one of the soundboards for the computer, and we could kind of do a fake interview with him.
Screw the fake interview. Let's contact California. Get the governor on.
You mean California?
Yeah.
He still can't say the state, the name of the state that he is governor of. But poor bastard can't afford speech therapy. Well, moving on. I know, Eric, you had an article for us to cover.
All right. It's my my 35 Reasons to Love Southside Gym. Probably my most dysfunctional article that I've ever written. It's pretty much an off-color piece that kind of rolled off my fingertips. But make a long story short, I started training at Southside, which is one of the world's premier powerlifting gyms, here in Stratford, Connecticut, last August when I moved down here. And, you know, it's just an incredible environment. And really, the whole tone of the article was it was more along the lines of, you know what, you know, a training environment is incredible, but at the same time, one of the reasons why I think a lot of our guys are successful is, you know, we don't take ourselves too seriously. We still have a lot of fun when we train. And, you know, one of the first things they taught me when I got there is, like, you got to have thick skin to lift here. And I think that's kind of been borne out in a lot of ways. But a lot of people just respond really well to getting into a new training environment. And that's something, you know, we can debate the minutiae of, you know, whether 5x5 is better than 6x4 or 4x6 and all that. But it really comes down to it. If you don't have good training partners and you don't have a good training environment, it, you know, all that really doesn't matter nearly as much. But it'd be interesting hearing your guys' thoughts on it.
Yeah, that was a great article. It's fun to read, too. I love these sort of top 10 lists. It's 35 reasons. But every one of them are just hilarious. I, you know, you can read through it in 10 minutes, and it just gets you laughing.
Yeah, yeah. I was the same way. I mean, it's an awesome article. And if you're listening to this right now, you might even want to pause the show and go to eliteFTS.com and check out the article. It's really worth a read. And, I mean, it's not even all just BS, like not just joking around and stuff. I mean, there's some good stuff in it as well. I really actually learned a couple of things from it. And I like the tidbit on the Playboys, which is really nice.
That is very unique. They're actually Playboys that are almost as old as I am in our bathroom, but you won't find that at your local commercial gym. But then again, I can't say I've ever actually seen a female lifter come into our gym. Not to be sexist, but that's just kind of the nature of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly wouldn't bring my sister, my girlfriend, my grandmother, my mother, anybody in there.
But so, you took care to make sure that to write down that nobody actually touches those magazines.
Exactly. Or at least I don't. I don't know. I can't speak for everybody else, but.
And there's no iPods either.
There aren't. There are definitely no iPods. We've got a temperamental old stereo system, but it gets the job done.
Nice. So. What kind of music do they play in there?
Oh, it's a lot of really loud, angry, belligerent, my mother didn't love me music. So you kind of, Korn's big, Hatebreed, you know, you get a good mix, you get some DMX, things like that. So I can list pretty much anything, but there are times when you come in during the week when it's a low time and someone just forgot to turn the CD player on, and instead you've got like Nick Lachey singing on the radio. I'm like, this is Southside, isn't it? We're not in the wrong neck of the woods, because you gotta drive right through the ghetto to get there. So that sounds kind of funny, but no, for the most part, it's pretty much the hard stuff. This morning was Rage Against the Machine for our squatting session. So
that can be dangerous. I had Rage Against the Machine in my earbuds one time, and I was like doing way too much weight for my own good. I better tone it down a little bit.
And then you throw yourself in the fire with guys who weigh about three times as much as you do. And,
yeah.
It's just a recipe for disaster, but a lot of fun. So we have a good time.
You should sneak some ABBA on the radio sometime. And run like hell.
Yeah. Well, there was a pun in that article about Enrique Iglesias, but I'll let the listeners check that out for themselves. So we used that fun. I think I wrote that in about 15 minutes. So
yeah,
I know you talked about the music in the gym, and I don't know about you, John, but when I go to my gym, it's, let's just say it's a gym that's full of a bunch of, I guess you'd say, upper middle class mothers. And they have a lot of those classes where it's just like aerobics, and they're taking up the basketball court, and they're playing their like bullshit old oh yeah, I should probably blank that out, but this is one of my soft spots. It's just I don't like the music that they're blasting, just crappy techno like remixes of songs for them to do their 20 reps of with their 5-pound weights out on the basketball floor, and you almost have to bring your own music or you're going to be driven nuts by the crap that they listen to, or even any time, like if you're in a gym and they're just playing music that's just crap over the satellite, like they use satellite radio stations and you don't even know what's going to be on when you show up.
Yeah. I've worked in a lot of gyms over the years, and one of the things that people are always going to fight about is the music. And
exactly.
To be honest, I got to UConn, and there's no music in any of the weight rooms. And
yeah.
Frankly, that's when I really started to get strong.
Yeah.
One less thing to worry about. And then you do, I think they've done some research that talks about, like, you know, when subjects are allowed to, you know, pick their own music, their endurance performance improves by, like, 22% or something like that.
Oh, really?
Compared to static, the sound of static or classical or something like that. So, hey, I mean, it works, but, you know, it's not always an ideal when you're in that big, you know, commercial fitness facility. Everybody wants something different.
Yeah, that's why MP3 players are a godsend.
There you go.
Yeah, you know, I got spoiled at the SMU gym in Dallas and knew the owner and the manager, so they played, you know, weightlifting compatible music. But after moving up here, I decided to be cheap for a while. I'm in Denver now, and I got a membership at a gym just down the street from where I work. It's just a small little gym, you know. Really nice owners, and they have everything you need, basically. But it tailors, like you said, Kevin, to the soccer moms and people coming in to do aerobics. And they have this damn TV set, and they have, like, a homemade aerobic video workout with techno remixes of Boston, More Than a Feeling.
Exactly.
What
that's what it
is. That?
Oh, God. It's awful. So, I bring in, like, these giant headphones and just crank up my music and my iPod.
That's why we only have one stationary cycle at Southside. I think it's pretty much just a coat rack and a place for the fat guys to lean on between sets. That's what Billy Bimnos said when he wrote his original article a couple of years ago, so...
The cardio station.
I haven't seen anybody ride on it in the 9 months I've been lifting here, so I should be more than that.
We actually have a special roundtable this week. Because Eric's on the show, we did have some user-submitted questions to go over. And also, just to start off the roundtable, Eric, what do you think about the philosophy of 5x5?
Oh, okay. We gotta get into the 5x5 discussion.
Jump right into the thick of things.
Long story short, somebody made a post on an internet forum about doing 5x5 for an entire year and whether people thought that would be bad. Independent over the whole, you know, concept of periodization and needing to change things up and, you know, the best program is the one you're not on. It kind of got me thinking about this whole evolution of a lifter thing that I've been thinking about over the last couple of months and wanted to write an article up on it. So figure what the hell, we'll do it on an audio cast and roll from there. But all right, so guys, you're going to help me talk this through. Okay, so we're beginning lifters, right? Okay, so we're stepping into a gym for the first time, right? So chances are we're going to go in and we're going to do 3 sets of 12 to 15 on pretty much everything we do. We're going to bench 3 times a week. And really, it's not going to matter what we can do. We're going to make progress regardless, right?
Right.
We're on the same page. Okay, so after, you know, a couple months, you know, we're getting purely neural strength gains, meaning our muscles are in our neuromuscular system is getting more efficient. We're getting more coordinated, so we're recruiting muscle fibers a lot easier. So, you know, after 6 to 8 weeks is when the muscle size gains start kicking in, and, you know, we're feeling good. So it gets to about that 5 or 6 month phase, and we're still doing the 12 to 15 reps, and things just aren't coming around as well as they should, right? So at that point, lifters can kind of take two different directions. First, a lot of people go right to the newsstands. They grab their local flex and, you know, they go to 4 sets of 12 to 15 instead because, you know, it's obviously that they're not doing enough volume, right? So, you know, these are usually guys that keep spinning their wheel and keep buying nitrous oxide and, you know, just blowing away their entire training career. Okay, and then we have another class of lifters that will usually go online or they'll find someone who's a little more knowledgeable and they'll start to realize, hey, I actually have to lift heavy things in order to get bigger and stronger. So, you know, previously they've done a lot of training to address hypoxia, meaning that there's not a lot of oxygen in the cell. So when you actually deprive the muscle cell of oxygen, you can get hypertrophy, meaning that the cells get bigger. But what they don't realize is that the other way to get a muscle bigger is actual mechanical damage to the tissues. So every time we lift very heavy things, we start to impose a lot of, you know, pure tissue damage. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So again, rather than the 12 to 15 stuff, they start to realize, oh, you know, these 5x5s, the 4x6s, you know, the 8x3s, the 6x4s, all these things are a lot better because, hey, I can still get my reps in, but at the same time, I'm getting stronger because I'm actually lifting heavy weights. I'm lifting at a threshold that's going to make me stronger. Okay, so that works for a while. And basically, you know, if you use the analogy that Dave Tate uses, I'm allowed to swear on this, right? So he talks about how there's shit, there's suck, there's good, and there's great. The four levels of lifters, right? Okay, so our 3x12 initially gets us from shit to suck. Okay, so then we take our, you know, our 5x5s and our 4x6s, and we go from suck to good. So we're reasonably good. You know, any lifter that's been lifting for about a year to 2 years and using this stuff, you know, in my opinion, everybody should be deadlifting 315. You know, people who are built structurally well and in good training environments should be up to 405. I mean, you know, granted there's age factors that play into it and everything like that, but, you know, generally speaking, if you're in the 20 to 30-year-old age range, that should be a very reasonable goal, and honestly, you should probably be a little bit stronger than that, but that's low end. Okay, so we get to the good stage. So in that case, a good, you know, high 300 deadlift, low 400 puts you above 95, 96% of the population, and, you know, you're in good standing. So the question is, why do so many intermediate lifters get stuck here? Why don't they actually get better? I mean, you don't see a lot of guys pulling 500, squatting over 400, benching over 300. It just doesn't happen, right? Mm-hmm. So the logical thing next is that they need to realize that the secret isn't to continue lifting moderately heavy loads for, you know, 5 and 6 reps. What happens is when you're doing that is you're really just conditioning yourself to lift reasonably heavy weights for more reps. Okay, the normal like resistance training adaptation falls off because you're always at 3 to 6 reps, which is about 80 to 90% for most people. If you can do 10x3 with 90%, the fact of the matter is that you really aren't strong. I mean, I look at my own numbers, and you know, I've got about a 617 deadlift at 165 at my last meet. So if I do the math out on that, I mean, if I tried to do 10x3, I'd probably be in the hospital. I mean, it just doesn't work out well. So where most lifters need to improve here is that they need to get a lot more lifts in over 90%, meaning that they're spending so much time in that intermediate zone. Really what they're doing is rather than conditioning their body to be strong for like single attempts and really building their overall threshold, they're just, you know, spending too much time in that middle range. I mean, a perfect example of this is if you look at how elite sprinters train. Okay, when was the last time you heard about elite sprinters preparing for the 100-meter dash by going out and running a bunch of 100-meter dashes? It makes right. No sense, right? And, you know, in the context of bodybuilding, you know, a 100-meter dash is like doing, you know, 4 to 5 reps, which is, you know, the traditional quote-unquote hypertrophy range for someone who has considerable training experience, right? Mm-hmm. But when you look at what elite sprinters do to get better, what is it? They run a lot of 10s. They run a lot of 20s. They might do some tempo runs in middle distance, things like that. The only time they ever run 100 meters is when they're running for money. That's the truth. It's not a very, very common occurrence, and that's something you can also learn from powerlifting contingents. So what I see a big need for in the intermediate community is to get away from this 5x5 stuff because it's not working. I mean, they beat their heads against the wall, and you know what? You can train for a year and go from a 315 deadlift to a 320 deadlift and, you know, using 5x5s, and it just doesn't make sense. But what a lot of people will respond very well to, and this is what we do a tremendous amount of at Southside, is we take a lot of lifts over 90%, but we just do one rep. I mean, we might be able to get two, but again, we're focusing on, you know, speed of execution. We're focused on just getting maximal loading. And whereas someone might come in and do 10x3 at 80% on that kind of program, they get 30 lifts at 80%. We might come in and do, you know, 7 singles over 90%. Be about the same amount of training time. Again, our percentage is a lot higher. We might not do as much total volume of work. So again, we're not going to get as much of a pure hypertrophy stimulus, but the difference between us and them is that we're looking to it more from a long-term context, meaning for me personally, it's going to be great for relative strength. I'm going to build a lot of strength in the short term. It won't build a ton of hypertrophy for me, but I can do that with my assistance work if I need to. But where that benefits your ordinary lifter who's interested, you know, I want to be strong, but I also want to put on some size, is that you're building your threshold a lot more. Your overall fitness capabilities are going a lot higher. So if you go back to those 5x5s and the 6x4s and things like that after the fact, you're going to be moving a lot more weight. You're going to be doing a lot more tissue damage with each rep. So there's going to be a much bigger hypertrophy stimulus. You know, it's a lot different, you know, doing a 5x5 with, say, 420 pounds if your one rep max is a 500 deadlift, as opposed to doing 5x5 with like 275 if your one rep max is like 325. So people just need to build their you know, their threshold a little bit more. This is something I talk about a lot in the training manual that I just finished up. It's geared primarily towards athletes, but there are actually a ton of great things for the ordinary lifter to realize. And one of the analogies I talk about a lot in there is I think of maximal strength as a glass. Okay, so the amount of maximal strength dictates how big your glass is. Okay, and you have all these other fitness qualities. Muscular endurance, which is going to be very applicable to people training for, you know, increases in size, you know, with hypertrophy. It's also applicable to sprinters and other athletes, you know, for whom power is a big deal, for whom, you know, agility and all these other things. These are like the qualities, and I look at those as the fluid within the glass. So a lot of people are so tapped out on all this pseudo-muscular endurance training that their glass is absolutely full with liquid, and that the only way that they really can get better in the long run is to do a lot more singles over 90% and get the size of their glass up so that they have that extra room for adaptation. Does that make some sense?
Yeah.
I'm talking myself in circles.
Well, how long would it take to stall out on single reps? I mean, is this something that you can...
See, you won't really stall out on the strength gain aspect. I mean, powerlifters get stronger year after year after year, and that's something I've experienced. The question is, you know, as an intermediate lifter, you know, it's going to take you from that good to great level of strength, and, you know, ultimately, you need to know, all right, you know, I might need to make some sacrifices in terms of the muscle growth. I mean, you'll maintain size, no doubt about it, but more importantly, as you're looking to it for the long term, so you know, all right, I'm going to bounce back to these 5x5s, these 6x4s, these 10x3s, and I'm going to be a lot stronger, and I'm just going to do a lot more damage. And truthfully, you know, Tony Gentilcore is a great example. He's one of our training partners. Tony came from upstate New York and moved out here and started lifting with us. And really, he was too weak for his cross-sectional area, which is a very common thing in people who have done a lot of this training. And he was, you know, kind of an upper-level intermediate. I mean, he had pulled close to 500, I think, when he got here, and, you know, he had a decent bench. But, you know, really where things started to take off for him was lifting with us and taking a lot more, you know, singles over 90%. And also that helped him because some of the volume he was doing was pretty absurd, and he was getting some serious joint issues. So he's gotten healthier, and he's gotten a lot stronger. And now he's in a position right now where if he went back and did a lot of volume – he'll grow like a weed. It's pretty incredible. So really, you know, lifters really need to constantly be evaluating, you know, where they are on the developmental scale. And so many people get caught up in this intermediate thing, and they think that the stuff that's going to get them from suck to good is the stuff that's going to take them from good to great. And as a result, you don't see that many great lifters who have really impressive strength, but also the size to match it. And again, you know, I compete as a 165, a 181, 198 power lifter. So again, I have to keep my weight down. So what I do is I spend a lot more time just doing that over 90% stuff, and you know, I keep my volume down on assisted stuff. But hey, if I want to go up a weight class, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to bump back. I'm going to take more threes, more fives, because I know that that's going to be the stuff that's going to put size on me real quick. So
give us an example. Let's say that, you know, that you have a 30-something-year-old guy who's right in between suck and good. You know, his deadlift is, you know, upper 300s, but he's stalled out. He's been doing the same workout for 10 years or 5 years, and he wants to get bigger. He wants to get stronger. He wants to get bigger, but doesn't realize that he needs more strength. What would your periodization look like if you were to add in,
again,
you know, some single reps?
That's the first thing I would do is again, look to improve his strength. I mean, that's the number one thing. And where people get bogged down is they use the old bodybuilding mindset of it's really more like a linear loading, in the sense that, you know, they'll pyramid volume over the course of 3 weeks, and then they'll take a mini back off week. And really, strength doesn't work that way. Strength is fatigue masks fitness, is a good way of looking at it. So if you want to display the most fitness, meaning be the most, you know, be your strongest, you need to remove that fatigue at certain times so that you can peak. You know, and that's what powerlifters do. If you think about it, you know, they take 1 or 2 weeks off before a meet, you know, or they do a lot of low volume stuff, and then they can, you know, go out and they can, you know, set a competition best that's, you know, 10% more than their training best. So where a lot of people make the mistake is they just do this continuous loading. So let's say 100% is your normal volume. They do 100%, 100%, 100%, and then in week four they do, you know, 60 or 70%. They back it off. Well, you know what? Your strength work late in the second week and all throughout the third week and into the beginning of the fourth week are going to really be impaired because you've done so much volume, and all that volume is inherently going to make you weaker because all that fatigue is accumulated, whether you perceive it or not. You know, it's not like muscular soreness. It's a central nervous system fatigue that's really going to impair your ability to really be strong. So where people are a lot better off is, you know, more of a conjugate approach, or, you know, even within that, even more so, looking to fluctuate training stress within the week. So personally, what I'm looking at is, you know, I'll do a high volume week, I'll do a medium volume week, I'll do a very high volume week where I intentionally impose a ton of fatigue, and then my fourth week in a 4 week training block is actually a very low volume week. So where I'm looking to see the biggest strength gains are right at the end of that fourth week, when I've removed that fatigue that I accumulated in week four, and the adaptations have really kicked in. So at the beginning of week five is when I'm really roaring to go, and I'm looking to set some big PRs. So a lot of people, you know, they run through like three cycles of that, and they get their strength up, you know, a good, you know, 15-20% sometimes, you know, from the intermediate level, and it makes a tremendous difference. I mean, granted, we're factoring all these other things. We do speed work, we do all these other factors that are gonna, you know, affect your recovery. But you know, I think the two big things are: one, you need to take more lifts over 90% if you're a lifter in that intermediate range, and two, you need to learn how to cycle your overall training stress a little bit better. You know, being very stagnant and constant in the way that you load yourself, and then just backing off every once in a while when your elbow starts to hurt or something like that, that isn't the way to get it done. You really have to plan on how you impose that stress and how you remove it.
Eric, where can people get that manual you were talking about? Is it just at your website?
There'll be information. If they want to subscribe to my newsletter at ericcressy.com, I should have some information out on it, hopefully within the next 2 weeks. I just went through the proofs today on the cover design and just the formatting stuff from the printer, and everything's looking good. We're just we'll be registering the domain name pretty soon and getting up for sale. But it's actually a real cool story on how it kind of came about. I started to write it last summer, believe it or not, as I saw. It was actually based on one athlete that I was working at with UConn. A lot of people probably heard about him. Is Hilton Armstrong, real incredible guy. I wish we could train 12 of them every year, but Hilton he was the one guy that hung around all last off season and had an incredible off season. It really got me thinking about, you know, here's what guys do when they're really, really successful in the off season. Looking at what he did, and you know, he went from pretty much a non-starter to Big East Defensive Player of the Year and a top 20 draft pick this year in the NBA draft. So it was just cool to see all his hard work go to the right place. But at the same time, I started to realize, you know, here are the training themes that really you know, hold true when dealing with athletes in the off season, and you know, seeing with a mistake that a lot of other guys that have been in his position before have made. So I'm really proud of him for doing really well. He's a perfect example of how you train in the off season. So more than anything, it kind of motivated me to put it all on paper, and it's been stuff that's kind of come from, you know, talking with a lot of their coaches and things like that. So real excited about it. My first kind of big solo project, so it should be real, real cool. But yeah, through my website would probably be the best information. Should be some stuff up in the next couple weeks.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Indeed. We'll head on to some of the listener questions. The first one: what do you like to do to help your athletes improve their speed? What are the most common weak points that you find that need to be strengthened in order to improve speed? And also, how do you address these?
Okay. Well, you can look at speed, you know, obviously in terms of the two factors that are always studies, stride length and stride frequency. And, you know, again, stride frequency, a lot of people believe, and, you know, myself included, is that it's genetically determined. All this stuff is kind of outside our control. You look at the elite sprinters, and to be honest, their stride frequency isn't much better than, you know, an amateur sprinter. But where they are superior is obviously sprinting mechanics. They have a lot more coaching. So mechanics are huge. I mean, if you want to be a pure flat-out sprinter, learn how to run right. You know, arm action, learning to relax the shoulders. You know, your cheeks should be flapping in the wind because everything is relaxed in your face as well. But beyond that, I always look to stride length. That's where I'm going to make my most impressive improvements with any athlete's speed. So again, you have to take into account the level of the athlete as well. If you have a young, untrained athlete, just having him go out and sprint is going to make him faster. And I think that's one of the problems with a lot of the speed training facilities that you have around nowadays, is that they bunch a bunch of kids into a group training. They run them, you know, ragged just because they're so young and they know they're going to adapt to it real quick. But really, when you get to someone who's an intermediate level into the advanced level, that's not going to work. In fact, it's going to make them worse. So what you need to work on is factors that are going to enhance stride length. So in our case, you know, we're looking at a pure strength work. If you have more strength, you're going to be able to propel yourself out further and take longer strides. But there's also a big need for range of motion work, you know, in this case, mobility work. And it's one of the reasons why Mike and I put our DVD together and really you're constantly looking to see, you know what, why isn't this athlete taking, you know, longer strides? Because when it really comes down to it, whoever takes the fewest steps in a race is always going to win. So things I'm constantly looking for, a very common inefficiency is, you know, just a quad dominant runner. So if you see a guy who's sprinting and his hips are bobbing up and down, and he's all over the place and it's not smooth at all, you know, he's probably running a lot with his quads. But if you look at a really, really good sprinter, watch him for the duration of like the 100 meter dash, watch some really solid wide receivers like a Randy Moss, things like that, and you're going to notice that their shoulders and their hips are perfectly level. It's almost like they're just gliding down the field or the track, and it's because they're hamstring and glute dominant, you know, posterior chain runners. And that's really the way you should run, because they're just much more powerful muscles, and it's, you know, it's indicative that your stride length is good and all that. So when I train an athlete first, I'm going to look for the inefficiencies. I'm going to look for the lack of mobility. And I'm just going to look at the absolute lack of strength. On top of that, one thing I do use is a test of what we call static spring proficiency. And I outline all these tests in the manual as well. You know, we just look to see, you know, is this athlete more reactive dominant? Meaning, does he do really well with making use of, like, you know, plyometric activities? He stored a lot of elastic energy in his tendons really well. So, or is he going to be kind of like one of those runners who tends to muscle everything? He's more strength dominant and doesn't tend to rebound as well. So there are different jumping tests you can use to assess this and, you know, and see where an athlete's individual weaknesses are. So if you find someone who's very static dominant, you do a lot more, you know, reactive work, meaning like, you know, plyometrics is the, you know, popular media has called them. Whereas if someone's very spring dominant, like you've seen a lot of, you know, basketball players who just spend a lot of time on the court, volleyball players, things like that, they respond really well to just getting much, much stronger. So there's all kinds of different ways you can improve speed, but those would be the big one. You know, always look to stride length first as your easiest means of improving things.
How do you measure stride length?
Stride length, again, a lot of this is video analysis and everything, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the best thing you do is if you get an athlete and you have him run a set distance, count the number of strides he takes on video. So that's right. The most common one and most, I guess, you know, easily, you know, affordable version. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, is it really even worth it to measure stride frequency? Probably not, because, you know, like I said, they're genetically determined. So just assume that everything you're doing is, you know, stride length based. And, you know, if someone has a lack of mobility, you can really tell. You can see it in their mechanics. You'll see a guy who has, you know, really poor backside mechanics if he's got some tightness in his hips, things like that. So, you know, once you know what you're looking for, it's, you know, it's kind of a slam dunk diagnosis every time, because a lot of athletes just have the same problems, and you know, it's, you know, just picking and choosing which ones you're going to correct first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll move on to the second question. What kind of movements would you use to develop ankle strength and stability, be it regular people or athletes such as football players?
Well, I guess the first thing you got to look at is, this relates a lot to the results of my master's thesis. I looked at unstable surface training in healthy trained athletes. You really need to weed out who your unhealthy athletes are, athletes who have a recent history of ankle trauma, you know, some kind of existing proprioceptive deficit. And those are the athletes who are going to respond very well to doing some unstable surface training, some balance stuff on like the DynaDisc, on the wobble board, things like that. So what you find in people with a history of ankle sprain is a residual proprioceptive deficit of the peroneals, which is the muscle on the outside of your shin. So those muscles decelerate inversion, which is the most common kind of ankle sprain. So if you have a history of some kind of ankle trauma, the first thing you want to do is, you know, chances are do some unstable surface training, because it is going to shore up that ankle. Again, this doesn't necessarily apply to healthy athletes, trained athletes, things like that. And, you know, my thesis results will probably be out this October. I'm not allowed to talk to him too much, but definitely in an injured population, that's one way to go about improving ankle strength. The next thing you're obviously going to want to look at is, you know, assess the range of motion in different directions. You know, is it insufficient? Is it excessive? You know, in what direction is the problem? We've seen great results with athletes just sending them for soft tissue work. You get a lot of residual scar tissue after any kind of ankle trauma, things like that. And, you know, especially in guys who tape too much, I think as a whole, especially in basketball players, we do way too much ankle taping. And it's one of the reasons why they have so many problems with their ankles, I think. But, you know, again, that's more of a theory than it is supported by research. But, in the general population, mostly what we're going to see are weakness in the dorsiflexors dorsiflexors and a lack of range of motion in dorsiflexion. So, meaning people can't pull their toes far enough towards their face because they're limited by, you know, tightness in their calves and things like that. So a lot of people respond really well to, you know, some soft tissue work on the calves, a lot of static stretching and mobility with, you know, calf mobilizations. At the same time, just doing some strengthening work on the dorsiflexors, you know, just dumbbell dorsiflexions, or, you know, work on the DARD device where you're just, you know, pulling your toes up to the face and trying to strengthen the front of your shins. So, I mean, those would be the big ones. And obviously this doesn't take into account, you know, any kind of abnormalities you might have in the structure of your foot, whether you have, you know, naturally pronated feet, whether you have naturally supinated feet, you know, 4 foot equinus. There are a hundred different conditions and compensations for each one. But in the grand scheme of things, yeah, those are the big things. You know, weak dorsiflexors, tight calves, and too much scar tissue, or just, you know, poor range of motion, whether it's excessive or insufficient.
Sounds good. A powerlifter at my gym says he only deadlifts heavy every few weeks, but does lighter sets weekly. He does a lot of deadlift-related work as well. Does that question make sense?
I was just trying to read that, too. I was like, what?
I guess, are we trying to justify his programming? I don't know. He never said if this guy had a good deadlift or not. That's the good question. I mean, he could be pulling 135 for all we know and bragging about it. I don't know. But, no, I mean, I think the take-home message on something like this is that there's always more than one way to skin a cat, you know. There's hundreds of different ways that you can improve your deadlift. I've done well with programs where I pulled once a month. I've done well with programs like right now where I pull twice a week. I do one day that's devoted primarily to speed. We do that after our heavy squatting movement on Wednesday nights. And then Sundays after we squat for speed, I do a lot more heavy pulling in like the, you know, the 2 and 3 rep range. So I'm pulling twice a week and it's working well for me now. So I'm sticking with that. And, you know, when I encounter other stuff that might be a problem, you know, then I shuffle things up. I've written a couple articles on it that might help. I wrote Frequent Pulling for Faster Progress. That's at elitefitness.com. And then I wrote an article called Deadlift Diagnosis, which is at T-Nation. So you can click to both of those through the articles page on my website. But, yeah, like I said, there's a thousand different ways to go at it. So really what you have to do is you have to assess your weak point, and then you got to kind of throw caution to the wind and just, you know, give a program a run and see what it does for your pull. But, you know, as a general thumb, I think people need to stop doing so many reps on deadlift. That's one problem that I think a lot of people have. So it's really not a lift that's meant to be done for, you know, I mean, I would say 8 reps at the absolute most, and that would only be in beginners. So, I mean, we have a rule at our gym. Nobody pulls deadlifts for more than sets of 4. So that gives you a frame of reference. I think it's more just because we're lazy powerlifters and we can't count to 5 anyway, but that might, you know, it could be some scientific rationale that I haven't figured out yet.
Now, do you prescribe different techniques for different body types? Like, I know people with shorter legs and...
You know, it's a very unique thing, and I've seen guys who you would think would be great sumo lift pullers, you know, who always pull conventional. As a general thumb, the guys who have, like, the squatter bencher build, you know, short legs, short arms, the long torso, they tend to do very, very well with sumo pulling. Personally, I tend to be a little bit long-armed, and I always pull conventional. Sumo has never really felt great for me. Down the road, you know, generally speaking, you see guys who are bigger respond well to sumo because their bellies get in the way when they try to pull conventional. So where you see the change over on that is usually about the 242 weight class going into the 275 class. So if you're in that little range, that's where you're probably going to want to, you know, contemplate switching over. But up until then, you're pretty much good conventional. And if you look at all the all-time record holders, you know, you see mostly conventional under, you know, 200 pounds. And as you go up, you're like a lot more guys over 200 pulling sumo. So it's just kind of where it is.
And also, one more final listener question. Who's going to win the World Series this year?
Oh, Red Sox. Come on. It's a no-brainer. Okay. That's all I need to hear. Good man. A couple of New England guys on here.
Yeah, I don't want to anger some of our listeners, but the Yankees, they do suck. I mean, I don't want to go into this whole discussion about salary and just the evil empire. And
I'm sneaking out of the room right now, the internet room.
No, we gotta have a fourth on, like maybe a Yankee fan come on sometime.
Yeah.
And
I'm putting up a good smoke screen on saying that I'm going back to Boston just to train people, but I gotta be honest, I'm just going back so I can be closer to Fenway. It's pretty bad. So
nice.
It's pretty painful. Southern Connecticut, we're officially Yankee country. They do Connecticut Day at Fenway Park, and they don't recognize Fairfield County. So, you know, you can't even get it on cable or anything like that here. So I've been scrambling to try to watch more games, but I just can't get them around here. So anxious to move north in, you know, 6 weeks here.
Also, just to let the listeners know, as of recording on Sunday night, the Red Sox are in first place. We're a half a game ahead of the Yankees. So that's for all you guys on the boards that said that Yankees were in first place, but only for 2 days. So hope you're happy with that.
No, we just jinxed it. We're going to lose our next 20 games, wood. I'm afraid. I know. If we were to go on the DL, we'll be pitching Lenny DiNardo every start.
Hey, you know, maybe he'll become a 10-game winner at the end of the season.
I hope so.
Oh, we should just have a Red Sox podcast that's affiliated with a FitCast.
We can get on as a sponsor.
Sponsored by the Red Sox.
Exactly.
They also could have a give us just some free tickets to show up to a game. That'd be nice.
Good deal. I'll work on it.
I had when I was in Boston for a year, I had a friend whose parents had season tickets to Fenway, and they had box seats. It was freaking amazing. I was lucky.
I got to eight games in the World Series year, and I didn't go to a single one last year because I moved south. And I'm pretty sure I'm good luck. And the problem is I wasn't there last year, so I don't know. There were 8-0 in the World Series year in games I went to, so I got to be good for something. Got to get that back there more often.
Actually, Eric, I just want to ask you, where can people just check out some of your articles? I know you're writing for Elite Fitness, and also they can get a hold of some of your stuff on your website.
Yeah, that's probably the best bet. Is just everything's kind of centralized. I have an article tab at ericcressey.com. It's ericcressey.com, and there's all kinds of stuff there. There's articles. There's there's a resources page that I just put up last week because I get a lot of emails from guys just curious about what kind of books and stuff I recommend and all that. So yeah, everything's kind of centralized there, and that kind of links out to where the products are and where the articles are and everything like that. So that's kind of the headquarters.
Sounds
newsletters
good.
And stuff.
I'm gonna have to buy that magnificent mobility DVD because I am the least flexible person you'll ever meet in your life. Like, my shoulder flexibility is awful. If I try to scratch my back, I can reach to my lower neck. That's about it. And my upper lower back, I have like a 2-foot gap in my back. I can't even touch.
No, it's been good. We've been getting some good feedback on it, so it's been real exciting. It's just something Mike and I saw a big need for, and actually the story of us filming it is actually pretty priceless. I flew out to Indianapolis to do it. And when we wrote the script, Mike was actually coming off of knee surgery, and we didn't know how much he was actually going to be able to do. We didn't know where he'd be in his rehab, so we pretty much just wrote up that I would do everything that wasn't really ground-based. So we did, Mike did 4 or 5 drills at the beginning that he could do, and then I jumped in, and I think we have a little over 30 drills in the DVD. I can't remember the exact number. So I did about 4.5 hours of dynamic flexibility that day, just with all the shoots and the outtakes and just like the misreads and things like that. And we actually trained right afterwards, and we went out to dinner afterwards, and it was the first time I had met Mike's wife, and she's actually a registered dietitian. And I think I had burned about 15,000 calories that day. We went to a Mongolian barbecue, which is like all you can eat dead animal flesh and vegetables, and I almost put the place out of business. I think I ate so much. It was all spicy food and everything, so I was just sweating like you wouldn't believe it. I think Mike's wife was afraid of me. I'm not sure, but it wasn't a great first impression, but man, I think I earned it between, it's about 7 hours of exercise continuously that day, so.
That's actually a really good idea. Next time I do a serious workout or some long workout, I'm going to have to hit up one of those Mongolian barbecues.
Those are incredible. I mean, they're huge in the Midwest, and I can't believe they haven't come to the Northeast. I should open one, get out of the fitness business altogether and just do that because it's a gold mine, but it's a real good place.
That should pretty much wrap it up for this week's episode of the FitCast. Thank you so much for coming on, Eric.
My
really
pleasure.
It
was a blast. Very mellow. Good times.
And I'll try to get down to Waltham soon.
All right, bring your camcorder. We'll be there.
Do a nice episode of the FitCast, and hopefully I won't throw up like some other people that...
Yeah, that was pretty wild. That surprised me when I heard that today. I didn't think I had that impression on people, but I'm hoping that he had some existing issue going on, but that was an amusing story to say the least.
You can only hope so. But before we leave, don't forget to check the show on iTunes. Also, look out for the next video episode of the FitCast. Always go to thefitcast.com for all the show notes and direct downloads. And that should pretty much wrap it up. So for this week's show, episode number 9, I'm Kevin Larrabee.
And I'm John Williams.
And I'm Eric Cressey.
And we'll see you next week. Don't forget to download iTunes. We'll see you for episode number 10 with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
and you know, he chatted up, and a real nice guy. He wants to do some group training with us, and he bring a couple of his buddies in and all lift together. You know, it went over well. We got him some information, and you know, he took off, and then sure enough, he posted on the forum the next day that I guess he pulled his car over to the side of the road, like right after he left the facility, he just puked his brains out. I'm like, I think my response to it was, you know, I had that effect on the opposite sex, but I didn't think I've ever had it on a personal training client or something, but I guess he'd been out all night or something like that, but it was a good chat. I don't think the people on the air are going to know what the hell we were talking about, though.
Yeah.